What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
Christine De La Rosa is a director of digital engagement with Kaboom.
True. True statement. There's an exclamation point at the end of that for those looking it up.
I always wonder how it is to market with an exclamation mark in a brand name, because I'm sure that there, you get a few challenges. You know, you can't quite put it in a URL.
It's really hard for brand guidelines and standards for partners and other people to incorporate it into whatever they're writing in their boilerplate language, et cetera. And you oftentimes read things online and go, ugh, it's not supposed to be possessive. Ugh, you're missing the exclamation point. Ugh, the capitalization. But honestly, when people don't know you, it's great for branding because you stand out, and anything to be disruptive is always a good thing.
Amen. Christine, welcome to Spiral Marketing.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. Well, so the topic for today is behavioral economics. Well, I'm going to go ahead and guess that most people are not immediately familiar with behavioral economics. And you and I had a conversation previous to this about behavioral economics. I thought it was very cool. So I'm looking forward to getting into it. Would you mind starting with something like a definition?
I would absolutely like to start there. It's not very simple to communicate, so I'm going to bring in a lot of examples. But before we do that, let's just take the step back and talk about what's basic economics in its purest form. If you remember back in college or high school or whenever you started to learn about economics, it's just about the factors that influence people in making decisions. What movie do you want to watch? Is a market going to go out there and buy a certain doll for Christmas? All of those factors go into basic economics, and it's a very rational way of thinking. You think, oh, this burger is delicious. I'm hungry. So the thought is, I'm going to eat it. You find a new burger. It's marketed as zero cholesterol. You want to go on a healthy diet. You're going to eat that. All of those decisions make sense. But when you throw in a little twist, and let's say, let's go with the burger example. The burger, some watchdog group goes out and says, actually, it's a lie. There's a ton of cholesterol in that. So I'm sorry to say, everyone that's had those burgers, you just have to reconsider what you're actually ingesting. You would think what the next step is, okay, that's terrible. I'm never going to eat these again. That doesn't actually happen all the time. And it's not rational, because people will think, well, I gave you the right information. You know that if you eat this, it's going to be an unhealthy choice, and yet you continue to eat it. I know I would continue to eat that if I have become hooked on the burger. And that's a bit of, that's thinking that the human brain doesn't always make the most rational choice. We have a faulty way of thinking, and that's a bit of what behavioral economics is. It's the fact that we don't live in a pure world of rational thinking, that there are other factors that come into play. And when you can understand what those factors are, you can kind of control the outcomes a bit more, and your marketing as a result can then, your marketing will then be influenced in a different way. You won't just tell people, this is the information and you should now go and purchase this thing or do that other thing. It's, oh, wait, there's some kind of inhibitor that's preventing you from making that rational decision. I have to dig into that. And once I uncover what that is and reveal it to you, you'll make the decision that I want you to.
Interesting. So it sounds like economics is very much not emotional, and behavioral economics factors in more of the emotional needs. Would you agree with that?
That's a much better way of saying it. Yeah, that's exactly why I came here, so that you could help me better communicate what this is all about. Yeah, I think the kind of industry that I like working in is an industry that focuses on selling not necessarily a product, but an idea, a concept, or some kind of behavior change so that people or society or some kind of group can be better off. So when you think about behavioral economics, it's hugely integral. Think about the public health industry. There are so many things that we want society to do or that we want to change so that people can be healthier. But people aren't making those decisions. And it's not for lack of access for educational information sometimes. It's because something is inhibiting them. And it's great to kind of dig into that and figure it out so that you can remove those inhibitors and allow them to make the choice that gets them healthier.
Very cool. Do you have a nice short example to kind of warm people up?
Yes, I do.
Cool.
Thank you for asking. I'm going to go with donuts. That is something that, at least here in DC, is one of the fads. We went through the cupcakes. We had the croissants. We had the
cronuts.
Cronuts. Ugh, you stole my next transition
I'm
example.
I'm sorry. You just set me up so well.
But people like them. They're a bit of an impulse buy. And sometimes you try to figure out how do you reduce the intake of those things when people know that donuts aren't all that great for you. Mm-hmm. So perfect study happened. They took a few different convenience stores and a couple other retail stores where donuts were right at the register. And lo and behold, people took them, they purchased them. Fast forward a few days later, they put a full length mirror up right next to the register. And right before they turned to pay, they saw the customers would see a picture of themselves in that mirror holding the donuts and assess, huh, maybe I can't afford to eat these right now. And it would reduce their purchasing.
Oh, that's awesome. Very cool. Well, when did you get started? When did you get interested in this topic?
I got interested in this topic before I even knew that it was an entire section of marketing. I worked on the Truth Initiative.
Of course, the Truth Initiative is, for any of those who have been living under a rock, is an initiative to help America. And is it international? It's supposed to be
national.
Right? It's national. Yep. So trying to get America to stop smoking.
That's right. There are a couple different brands within that house. One is the prevention brand, which is Truth. It's to prevent young people from beginning to become lifelong smokers or tobacco users. And then there's the X brand, which is more about those smokers that are ready to quit and just need help through that quit process. Hmm. So it was really interesting. I started off on the X brand, and behavioral economics comes right into play as far as addiction goes or any kind of normative change that you want to change. And instead of just telling smokers, hey, here's some information, you should probably quit. The research shows that there was something that was preventing them to do that. And if you quit cold turkey, sometimes it works and sometimes you can't escape it. I'm going to go down memory lane. I worked with a few people that used to work in drug and alcohol quit lines and would be support people for those that needed some kind of community to help them through the process. Okay. And they would compare people that tried to quit smoking to the people that tried to quit heroin or harder drugs. And then they had the people that were quitting all of the above. And what they heard was that heroin and harder drugs were much easier to quit than smoking, which I don't know for you, but that's counterintuitive for me a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Right. And so they tried to get underneath that, and they found out that with the heroin addicts, they had a specific dealer that they talked to. They had a specific house or alley or place where they purchased their drugs. And if they cut that out of their lives, they essentially cut out the addiction. But with smoking, the triggers are throughout your life. You drive to work, you hit traffic, you want to smoke. You get a really big meal, you feel full, you naturally want to smoke. You're out, you're drinking alcohol. Those two things go hand in hand. You want to smoke. Are you going to cut out your ability to go to work, your social activities, your ability to have a large, satisfying meal? Those are everyday things that are part of your life, and it's just not as easy to cut those out. So you quit smoking, you also quit those aspects of your life, and you kind of have to relearn everything. So the inhibitor there were the triggers for smoking. It's not that these people knew they wanted to quit, and that's all they had to do to quit. They had to remove the thing that was affecting them to fully go through that decision. And so instead of reaching for a cigarette when you're getting yelled at by your boss and you feel like smoking, is there something else you can put in your hand that you can occupy yourself with after a really big meal? Is there something else that you can do to have a little bit of it's not dessert, but just a bonus activity after your meal? We call those separation exercises. And so that had to be incorporated into our marketing. How do we put into the hands of smokers that want to quit a different or a replacement exercise than smoking? And if that was successful, then they would perhaps listen to us in the next message that we would provide to them. A bit of an epiphany happened to me. Marketing has to be much more than the advertising, the content, the information. It has to enable people to live differently in order to change lives long term. And through other opportunities to work with groups of people, public health groups, this is always the same thing. It always comes down to, what do you expect when you give people information, some kind of educational material? And if that thing that you expect doesn't happen, what's the inhibitor that's preventing these people from realizing that outcome? And then how do you market around that specific inhibitor, that challenge?
Very cool. I wrote down enable people. That's all interesting. It frames up the idea of marketing an experience in a very different way. Do you have a good example?
Today, everything that I do at Kaboom is all around behavioral economics. I geek out about this because I think it's not only a new way of marketing and a new way of behavior change across the country or globally. It's a new way of thinking about how a brand can become a movement. You don't have to wait for a trend to happen. You can just reposition a brand so that you're no longer selling an idea. You're selling a way to change life. And so at Kaboom, for almost 20 years, people know Kaboom for building playgrounds, particularly playgrounds in low-income communities and play deserts, places where cities and families don't have access to places like playgrounds regularly. Kaboom is a machine at it.
Play desert.
Can you imagine? I mean, think about it when you were a kid.
Oh, man, there were so many playgrounds.
Right?
And walk to four of them.
That's actually really impressive.
Isn't it? Yeah, there was a church, there was elementary schools. Yeah.
Like, what did the playground do for you? Did you make friends there? How did it make you feel?
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. I think I can remember feeling empowered to do things that I couldn't normally do. I remember the beginnings of weird little social structures and teams during games where we could play a game against another team and little camaraderie. Of course, there was fights and kiddie drama as well, and lots of slides and jumping off swings.
That's super healthy. I mean, even the fights, those help kids learn how to solve problems. It forges relationships. It teaches kids how to interact with other people. I think that's the points that you're hitting on are a little bit less traditional, because I think people think, oh, play, physical activity. I'm thinking about today in the obesity issues. Yes, we need more play because we need more physical things, but you've really touched on the core parts. You get points for this.
Thank you.
Play basically provides well-rounded children so that they can thrive later in life. And a playground is what a lot of people think back to when they're younger for developing all these skills and playing with other kids. And so a lot of people think, great, Kaboom builds playgrounds. They bring communities together. It's not just an organization that dumps a bunch of money down and saves a community from lack of play. That's not true at all. People know Kaboom as the place that brings funding partners and community partners and individuals together and teaches them, here's what you do when you want to take care of your community. You do something like this. And in this specific example, on this day, you're building a playground because you're putting kids first. And for 19 and a half years, that has been amazing. We've built almost 150 to 200 playgrounds every single year. It keeps growing, and you think that's a lot of playgrounds and that's a lot of kids. But when you look at the bigger problem, and every single organization, I'm sure, has to do this, they have to go back to their core. What's their mission? What's their big objective? Our big problem are the kids that don't have access to this. And think about the number of kids in poverty that don't have access to this. There are 16 million kids today that are living in poverty. Wow. And at the rate that we're building playgrounds, while very impressive, that's never going to reach the scalability of the actual problem. So when I came on board at Kaboom, the strategy was expanding to include not just playgrounds, but bringing play everywhere. How do you make sure that kids aren't just getting to a playground, but they're having play at school within their curriculums, when they're having recess on the playground there, when they're walking to the grocery store, when they're errand running with parents, when they're going through transportation? If you bring play everywhere, you won't have to worry about making the decision of whether or not play is relevant. So bringing it back to behavioral economics, we worked with a company called Ideas 42 based out of New York. And we surveyed a lot of different citizens within cities. And I'm talking about cities here because over 80% of the kids in poverty are living in cities. And again, if we want to go at scale, that's where you go. That's where you target. So in cities, these residents talked about when they were actually with their kids. They said, I'm with my kids when I'm running errands. We're going to the grocery store. We are going to the health clinic. And when you add up all those hours, it's a long time. Think about, use public transit all the time. I think about how long it takes for me to get from my place to the nearest metro stop, the train. and then waiting there for the train, then getting on the train and taking that journey, and then going from the train stop all the way to the next destination. And then let's say I was with a kid and we went to the laundromat, waiting for all your clothes to wash and then dry, and then going all the way back.
Hours.
Right?
Hours and hours.
And that's one activity. Mm-hmm. So one of the factors that impede adults from making the decision to go out and play with their kids is that there isn't enough time sometimes. And maybe it isn't, hey, let's create a great PSA that inspires parents to go out to a playground. Maybe it's, hey, why don't we bring the play to the parents during their errands? And so a lot of our strategy isn't focused on just the playgrounds. It goes beyond that. It's focused on getting cities to create the infrastructure and the environment so that the entire city is family friendly.
Excellent. Okay. What's inhibiting the behavior? Do you know?
So the behavioral barriers have to do with the decision making for adults. And so the structural changes that we're asking a city to make is part of it. So instead of having to say, do I decide to go to the park or do I decide to go about my day? 9 times out of 10, the adult is going to say, I'm going to go about the day. So to take away that inhibitor, we're going to take away the decision altogether and transform the bus stop into a fun game. I was out in San Francisco and I saw a bus stop that was made out of different sized stumps. So they're all different. They're chairs, and it's great for seating for people of all sizes. But for kids, they're climbing all over it. They're trying to size it up. They're pretending that they're in a circus and they're using their imagination and it becomes a play, right?
Sure.
So by doing this and bringing play everywhere, you're taking the thought process, the decision-making factor out of it. So moments of potential frustration are converted into moments of joy. And when you see more of these things around, I think everyone will understand that these are the things that parents want, that kids want, that families want. And so cities are going to want to do more of that. So part of our marketing strategy then is to showcase these aspects, the what could be to attract these kinds of families to your city or to make your current families in your city happier. So instead of talking about how you should market your parks more, we should talk about how we should market the right kind of infrastructure a little bit more.
Very cool.
Yeah, that's one aspect. Another thing that impedes people from playing more as a family is the feedback loop. I'll use a smaller example before I go back to Kaboom, okay. But we're going to go back to junk food. This is
we always do.
It's a little bit personal. So there was a study with Pringles cans. Familiar with Pringles chips?
Yes, I am. And the Mitch Hedberg joke comes to mind. People can Google that.
Do you happen to know their slogan or their tagline? I'll give you a hint. When you have one Pringle, do you stop there?
Oh, no. Yeah, that's right. You can't eat just one.
That's right. That's okay. Right. And so...
And there aren't tennis balls inside. That's reference to the Mitch Hedberg joke. Sorry. Go ahead.
So people, what that speaks to is people eat Pringles by the quantity, the mass quantity. And there isn't necessarily a feedback loop to say, hey, you may have had enough. It's about portion control. And some people think that if I were just told I've had the allotted amount or that I've had a lot, I might stop myself sooner. So Pringles... I think they looked up the serving size for what one person should be eating for the day, not of Pringles, but of fat, cholesterol, all the saturation that junk food brings. What's your total serving for the entire day? And we'll mark it off with a different color chip. So let's pretend you're having sour cream and onion Pringles chips. They're a little bit yellow. Mm. Every fifth chip was red. It was dusted with red flavor of some sort.
Just 5 chips.
That's right. And so every fifth chip that the people in this study ate made them stop and think, oh, and I just had another serving. Oh, and I had another one. And I don't know how long it took for them to slow down, but that feedback loop reminded them that they need to portion control themselves as opposed to keep going. So bringing it back to play, another inhibitor is that there is no feedback loop of whether or not you're playing enough. There is no feedback loop of whether or not you're not playing too much. If that makes sense, that's the double negative. Mm-hmm. So think about why kids might be playing less today. One of the examples of kids playing, or one of the reasons why kids might play less today, is screen time. And that's not just video games. That could be television screens. That could be looking things up on an iPad. It's a little...
Phones, their parents' phones.
That's right. But there's not a lot of feedback loop there. There is no timer ding on the TV set. There is no game that's saying every, I don't know, 10 minutes or whatever the interval of time is to say it might be too much time for you to play. And unless a parent is monitoring the child the entire time, even the kid itself doesn't get that. Now think about playing outside in the sun. You're sweating, you're getting sticky, your clothes are starting to feel a little bit uncomfortable. Those are all great things when you're having a good time and you're being physically fit, but that's a feedback loop to tell you I've been playing a lot. But in contrast, when you're with technology, there is no feedback loop to tell you you haven't been playing enough or you're on screens for too long. And so working with partners that try to accommodate for that or that are trying to think of ways to incorporate feedback loops into the actual devices, that's going to help us enable play to go everywhere as well.
Oh, that's great. That's a great example. Well, okay, if we can speak more generally for a moment, hoping we can put together a message, maybe it's another fictitious example, or maybe it's just an opportunity that you see that how people can incorporate this into their own marketing.
Yeah, this is great. So I've got a broad idea on how to tackle that, as well as some specific examples. But one broad way is positioning your message. I think a lot of marketers, when I worked on the Truth brand, we always wanted to look at our media dollars and say, where's the best place to reach our teen demographic? And what's the most cost effective way to do that? So we wouldn't just use the shotgun approach and advertise everywhere on television. You'd want to put your commercials in the places where the teenagers were watching most, and not just all teenagers, but the ones that were specifically your demographic. Or think about, it doesn't have to be the Truth brand. Any brand that has a lot of media to spend, you have to carefully pick where you're spending your dollars, who you're reaching, and how many at that time. But if what you're marketing is a message, is just information, are you actually getting at the people when they need your message most? So for example, if you are marketing the X brand to help smokers quit, should you just look up your profile of your smokers, learn that they're into NASCAR and they are mostly in these particular regions in the United States or these parts of a city? Is that going to be enough? Or do you want to get them when they're in the mood for smoking, when they're having trouble with some kind of separation exercise, when they are experiencing the triggers for wanting to smoke? Where are the challenges in your train of thinking? Where are you skipping so that you're not having a rational decision-making process, and perhaps position and advertise yourself there?
Interesting. Have you ever read The Power of Habit?
I really should. It's one of those books that are always on the list for people to read, but talk to me.
Well, it talks a lot about this. It goes in all kinds of directions, and they're all deep rabbit holes. They're all super interesting. One of the things they talk about is how Target accrues data, and they can predict with some impressive accuracy when somebody is pregnant based on their buying behavior.
Yeah.
And other things like when they're going to get married, when they're going to buy a house. It's incredible.
I can't remember if this is in recent memory, but there's a rather large retailer that figured out so much information about its customers that it knew if you purchased a certain amount of product in a certain amount of time, they would know that you were pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so they found this out and they mailed coupons related to pregnancy to the home, and the person had not yet told her husband. And the news broke that way, that this retailer knew that someone was pregnant before everyone in that family did.
Right. The Power of Habit had an example where it was the daughter. It was a daughter, and the father got super upset and then had to backpedal and say, no, actually, you were right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fascinating, because I'm not sure nobody ever thinks about their customer as much as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And while it may seem or sound creepy or something to forecast someone's behavior, it's really not, because you're just estimating what their need is going to be so that you can solve it before mm-hmm. it even occurs, before the problem occurs.
That's right.
Interesting. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that thinking about how you can solve the problem and try and attack that problem when it's happening is easier said than done. I think that sometimes marketers rely on the fact that information is really powerful and that's all people need. But humans are not perfect creatures. There are a lot of factors
we're so close.
Yeah. But there's just so many factors that go into decision making that, of course, the rule of thumb is make everything as easy as possible for your customer, for your user, for your end person. If there are other factors that could get in the way, you need to go where those are. You can't just provide the information to a person and expect them to change their ways. I want to also say that behavioral economics doesn't just relate to public health. It's not just about behavior change at scale. Behavior could be behavior to sign up for something or to pick one movie over another and actually decide to do that. Another thing that is popular within behavioral economics, and we're not going too much into the science, but heuristics and framing and things like that are subsets of behavioral economics. And in framing, there's a game of comparison where someone can't make a decision because even though they have content about, let's say, a movie, for example, they just simply may not be compelled by the director that's headlined on it. So framing tells you to give a comparison for another movie that this director did or a movie that you hate that didn't have that director. And the person will be able to make a choice. That's why when you see trailers, you oftentimes see in the beginning from the director that brought you XYZ or from the producers that gave you ABC. This is a good way to help people evaluate whether or not it's a good decision to go and see a movie.
Remember that movie you loved? Well, think of this movie when you think of that movie.
That's right. Ride the coattails of whatever you can, and that'll help people make a more informed decision. You would hope that the merit of the story alone or whatever is a part of the core part of that movie would be enough for a person to go see it. But sometimes it's just not enough, and you need other factors to help make that influential decision.
Sure. So what else did you want to touch on?
I think behavioral economics has been around for a long time, but it's always evolving. And when I say behavioral economics, I mean specifically to marketing. Mm-hmm. What's really interesting for me is figuring out what's next. Okay, so we're studying all these factors. That's essentially the psychology behind marketing that's somewhat pervasive already. What else can happen? Some exciting work is going on, specifically with platforms that are aggregating masses and masses of data, where they're not just looking at the outcomes as a result of certain behavior, but the outcomes as a result of other outcomes. Let me give you an example because that's super theoretical. Let's say that you are on a petition site. You're familiar with change.org?
Loosely.
Or Care2, or anywhere where there's a platform for people to take action. You get a lot of data on users, on where they're signing up for petitions. If they signed up for one, what's the next petition to take? If they're clicking on petition areas, but they're also interested in reading articles that are related to current events, put all this data together and see if one action affects the next. So marketers will often, especially in digital engagement, will be focused on how do I get you to do this one thing? And on a site like that, the first thing you want them to do is start a petition or on a lower level action, sign a petition. Now, what if after you do those things, you also get served another petition to sign or asked, prompted to be part of another start to another petition? Or what if from there you're prompted to read an article? There are several actions that are now being prompted and put together, and all that data could say if you sign two petitions and read one article, you are more likely to share something on social, on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or somewhere else, and tell someone in real life about it. Or if you do 10 petitions plus you post on social media and interact with people on social, you will then be most likely to go to your town hall and speak at an event. And so the power of the cumulative effect of different behaviors is really interesting. And I think the fact that we're in a kind of a data boon right now with different platforms, that's sort of the next horizon for behavioral economics and marketing. It's how can I not only try to get people to do this one thing, but how do I get people to do multiple things so that in aggregate, they will do something even bigger?
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent. That's so cool. So if you think of the end result that you want to occur, then using this frame of thinking, you could consider what other actions would help lead towards that. And it's not as simple as, you know, digital used to just be, well, what other web pages can we put on the website? Mm-hmm. You know, well, does the About Us put enough trust in? Do they want to read blogs after that? You know, with this kind of data, we have the opportunity to learn a lot more about what they may need on that customer journey.
Right. Right. Awesome. And I think technology is just enabling us to do this now. Mm-hmm. It took a long time for us to not only take a look at Facebook analytics or Twitter analytics, but then also cross-pollinate and compare. If I see analytics on one social platform, how does that affect the other? And how can I look at that in aggregate? Mm-hmm. But then combining that with your Google analytics for your website, and then combining that with your email analytics, and then combining that with on-the-ground real-life behavior or ticket purchases, and playing with other partner websites or vendors that you participate with in an ecosphere of transactions. I mean, there are still tools being built right now to be able to synthesize all this information. And the fact that it's happening now is just saying that it's now time to be able to influence people. I'm actually afraid, I swear, like 20 years from now, I'm going to go walk out of my home. I'll probably buy a drink somewhere, which through a credit card, so they have that data. And I'll look on my phone or whatever technology I'm using to access some kind of computer interface. I'll do something on that, message someone, and that will predict my ability to take a nap 4 hours later or something like that. That's the kind of data science that I think we're at the forefront of. And it's the predictability is going to be down to a science in the near future.
Wow. You could just imagine the notifications. Christine, bring a pillow with you today because you're going to want to take a nap around 4:30 and you're not going to be anywhere near a bed.
Think about it. Are you familiar with the Internet of Things?
Yeah.
That's what it is. The information that you're plugging with your refrigerator, it's going to tell you you're out of milk, or you're going to be out of milk in 2 days, because hooked up to all of your detergent use and the behavior around how often you're doing laundry, they know that you're going to go out in a couple days and do something rather rigorous, and you're going to drink the rest of the milk or whatever. That's probably not the thing that you hydrate with, but you're going to drink some other beverage.
It was a bad choice.
And you're going to have to go to the store. That's great. The Internet of Things isn't just connectivity to household products and being able to store information about your daily life. It's about aggregating all of that and predicting what you need before you even know it yourself.
Very cool. First of all, do you have any other tips?
Yeah, I'll give examples for the smaller actions to change behaviors of what you can do. It's something that I think is fundamental, but I'll say them anyway. Default options. Giving people a choice is sometimes paralyzing. My brother and sister say this a lot, but when our parents give us a long list of options, sometimes we just stop and don't choose anything because it's just too hard of a scenario. Or really little kids do this too. When you give them maybe like 3 or 4 different options and everything is equally great to them, they don't choose to do anything. So limiting options is always best. One or another, voting between two things, will help people make decisions. And when you don't want people to make a decision and you want to push people to do just one thing, giving them the default option will take away that ability to decide, and it won't matter. People don't sometimes just don't want to have to make the decision. So that's why when people sign up for emails, the default is an opt-out box, so they don't have to think to check the box. It's not just that the age-old internet users are lazy. That's why the opt-out box is there. There's a little bit more to it. It's that you're providing less options, and so you're giving people or you're taking away an inhibitor that would otherwise make people have to think and possibly not receive your emails. Another thing is time delay. So there is a little bit of an emotional sadness when you spend your money.
Right.
So in order to delay that sadness, the same cost for a car today versus paying for a car over 20 easy payments or something like that is going to be more appealing. And going back to behavioral economics, in a purist sense, it's the same price. The same decision should be made in both scenarios. But in the case where you're paying for a car over 20 simple installments, you are removing the bad feeling you get when you're parting with your money. right away. You're delaying it to start maybe a month later, and you don't have to, it's zero money down. And starting in the second month or month, whatever, you start your smaller payments then. So take that principle of time delay that we totally get for paying for large purchases and do that for a behavior that needs to be stopped. Let's say that you're addicted to something, and I'm not talking about substances necessarily. Maybe you're addicted to a certain habit. Maybe you're addicted to a game that you love too much and you can't stop. If you incorporate the time delay principle, it'll hurt less. Tell yourself you are not going to stop playing that video game now. You're going to stop in 20 minutes. You might be more open to getting on board then, that sort of thing.
Very cool. Okay. And how about other resources?
I tend to just do the internet search for behavioral economics articles. There are a lot of top fives, top 10 things you can do and blog entries about that online. But when you read the research papers about behavioral economics, you learn a lot more about the philosophy behind what you have to do. So instead of just seeing the tip about break up your payment into smaller ones or start the payment process later, they'll tell you the idea behind it, which is the time delay concept. And I think it would be a little bit more helpful to read those things. If you're interested in the behavioral economics for Kaboom, if you go to kaboom.org, that's KABOOM.org, there's a section under playability called research. And we detail out all of our research in a white paper and a simplified version for those that don't have the time to get through it all.
Excellent. And I'll link that along with every resource we mentioned or any link at spiralmarketing.com for the show notes of this episode.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Awesome.
So what do you think the future of this topic will look like? What do you think? Hopefully it'll start. It's going to come. That's an absolute. But what do you think about the future and the adoption and what that will look like beyond what we've already discussed?
I think marketers are going to change the way their CTAs, their call to actions, look like. They're going to think about the data points that can be incorporated into changing outcomes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure more jobs will be created for data scientists, and storyteller marketing won't just be people that can craft the perfect emotional piece of content. It'll be the storytellers that can relate to whatever the inhibitors are in the decision-making process. I think that platforms that aggregate data are just going to get bigger with their data centers, and you'll have a lot more to do. There'll be a lot more activity in hubs like social media platforms. When that happens, the engineers, I guess, behind that and the research teams and the data scientists will be using that to help predict different behavior, not just on the site, but outside of that. And so I think more properties and more partnerships are going to have to be formed to market to people.
That was an excellent answer.
Well, all right. I get points.
You do. You get points. I meant to ask you, is there any platform that is somewhat accessible that you're familiar with? So a platform to facilitate behavioral economics.
Well, the company that Kaboom worked with is named Ideas 42. There are other firms out there that specifically focus on the science aspect of behavioral economics. So that means not just appealing to the marketers as customers, but also organizations in general and how to frame their strategies to cater to better decision-making skills. I don't know of any apps, but I'm sure that's a good idea for someone to start.
Okay, great. Well, what's the best place for people to go online to learn more about you and to reach you?
I'm happy to give out my email address, cdelarosa@gmail.com.
Excellent. Okay, perfect. Well, Christine, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. For those of you that are listening, there are magical unicorns in the studio, and you're missing out. If you ever get the chance to hang with Carl, you should try to come down to the studio.
Your check is in the mail. Thanks.